I'm Dr. Scott Lyons, and you're watching or listening to The Gently Used Human. Have you ever felt like you're constantly distracted, struggling to focus, or wondered if you might relate a little too much with those ADHD info videos on TikTok? Well, today we're diving into the complex world of attention with Dr. Sasha Hamdani, a respected psychiatrist, best-selling author, and entrepreneur. Dr. Sasha brings a unique perspective to the table, shedding light on the often misunderstood realm of attention disorders. I'm Dr. Scott Lyons, and you're watching or listening to The Gently Used Human. Let's get this party started. Sasha, welcome to The Gently Used Human. Hi. Where the hell have you been all my life?
I mean, in my room, doing telehealth. That's where I've been for 4 years.
Shit, well, welcome out of your room, kind of.
I'm still here, but yeah, hi.
You're still
but
here.
I'm so excited hi. To be here, and I'm so excited to be on the podcast. I've been so excited about this.
Oh, we are so excited to have you. I love all the work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
And I want to dive right into it. You ready?
Totally.
Are you ready?
Oh, I'm so ready.
I'm ready. Here's a go. Here we go. Here's a go. That's my new sentence.
Here's a go.
All right, Sasha. Yes. I'm going to do it in my sexy voice. Okay. No, my question for you is, what is attention? Who's got it and who don't got it?
So here's the deal. Attention, I think inherently is your ability to focus and to fine tune, to utilize numerous different parts of your brain to attend to either a singular or multiple topic kind of thing. Who has it? Everybody theoretically can pay attention, right?
And then, have you met my exes?
Okay, no, I haven't. So maybe my whole answer will change. But like, in theory, people have this capacity to maintain attention. It's how you regulate attention. It's how you are able to sustain attention. It's how you're able to attend to it initially and get into a subject. It's how you transition from one topic to the other. So that's kind of where people, there are different shades and nuances about people's ability to regulate their focus and attention.
Yeah. One of the things that I remember in school too about attention that actually kind of blew my mind when we were looking at some of the definitions of it was like, it's not just about what you focus on, it's also about what you kind of ignore and your capacity to ignore, which I was like, oh my gosh, that's kind of a wild concept. Mm-hmm. That attention is about what you're able to ignore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it, especially given what we're going to talk about. I think it's very relevant,
what
right?
We're going to talk about. Yeah. And like, I think, what do they call it? Like discrimination of stimuli is like the official sexy scientific nerdy
it's
name
so sexy,
for it.
Yeah.
Super sexy. It just means like, can you center your focus on something or some things? And can you like switch back and forth? Yeah. Can you also ignore or discriminate? Meaning like, can you move away from a focus or something like a stimulus?
Right.
Which I don't know.
You don't know personally, or you don't know if anybody is capable of?
Well, you know, attention, and we're going to talk about the nuance and the uniqueness of each of us within our attention. And one of the things I know too about as we dive into the world of focus and attention, who's got it and who doesn't, is like we're also talking about like capacity and duration. So like how much and how long. And so like everyone has a this is a question. Like everyone has a different amount they can and a timing that they can, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to get even more complicated, that changes, right? Depending on like what's going on environmentally and things like that, and like emotionally and extrinsically, so that your capacity and your duration of focus can absolutely be impacted by all of those things. So you can look like a completely different case depending on what's going on.
Is there like a baseline I come into the world with and then I'm going to kind of carry on through my whole life, and like how much and how long kind of shifts in relation to that baseline, or it can radically change through our lifetime?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think there's some people that may be able to harness their focus a little bit better, like straight from birth. But I think everybody, as they grow and mature and they learn how to deal with extrinsic forces, they cultivate that skill set. So some people become really good at it and some people are not so great at it. And, you know, so then you get like, what was my original baseline capacity to be able to do this? And what were my skills that allowed me to hone that ability? And then that's where you figure out in your early adulthood and late adulthood, like where you fall on that spectrum.
Mm.
Yeah. But you can look really different at different parts of your life.
Yeah. I mean, thinking back now in my life, and we're going to talk about each of our own relations to attention in the show. And I'm really excited to talk about it because we actually have a lot in common in that material.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. I can't wait to dive into it. But I think like, I mean, attention for me is like a highlighter. Like, and as you're reading through a book and you're highlighting shit, and it's the sections that stand out that where you attend to, and like that's attention, that's the focus. And to me, you know, as especially as a kid, it was like knowing what to highlight,
yeah,
and not knowing what to highlight,
yes.
And I couldn't discern that
your whole page would be yellow,
but <Yeah. laughs> my whole page was absolutely yellow or nothing,
yes. Yeah.
Was that similar
Very
for you?
Very similar. And then I remember like going, I had this like, I was in a biology class in high school and my mom was like, you're going to end up highlighting the entire book, which by the way is a library book. So why are you writing it in the first place? But like, so what is important? And I remember like frankly telling her like, I don't know. All of this could be important. So I want to highlight it.
Yeah.
And she's like, no.
No. I know. Could you ever, you know how like people who could speed read and like move through and identify important words and hold on to the important words? I don't understand that, but like I appreciate the idea.
It's like I would love that. I don't have that ability for sure. I think that I probably read at a faster pace than many people. I think I retain much less. Because I think I like breeze through stuff without actually getting conceptual mastery of it. Like my eyes move faster than my brain does. So
that's really interesting. Yeah.
And that might be a me thing. I don't know. I think like it takes me a while. Like I have to really, 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 really be engaged in something that I'm reading in order to comprehend it on the first pass.
I can appreciate that. I'm a really slow reader. Yeah. Like when I was in school, especially in grad school, like where people would read through and they could just go through and find the highlights, so to speak. And everything was highlighted to me. And so I would spend all night, literally till 5 a.m. every day reading the chapters, which, you know, then I had no sleep. And that's, we know, is an effector on attention and focus. But I would have a conversation with myself about each thing. And that's how I would remember. Like, and so when I was in classes, like I could be in that conversation and I could remember all these random details that probably weren't so necessary, but I could do it because I had a conversation in my head around each thing that I highlighted, which was pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, more power to you. I mean, there is incredible value in being able to do that. I don't think speed matters. Yeah. I think it's ability to master the information in front of you.
Which, yeah, but it's also not very time efficient.
True.
Like, you know, when you're having to do about 10 courses, do, you know, residency, doing all this other stuff, it's kind of not so efficient too. I mean, this is the thing, interesting thing about attention when I was always so like, I don't understand. It's the ability to tune things out.
Yeah.
And I was like, why? As a kid, I tuned everything out or tuned everything in.
Yeah, I know. I know. And I'm thinking about like, even in adulthood, like I don't process things if I type it. It just, like it doesn't go into my brain. Like I need to physically write stuff. And so I'm like the only person in my practice who, like as a patient is talking, everybody else totally reasonably typing on their computer, right? And they're taking their notes, they should be doing. I'm like writing on a piece of paper and then later I have to transcribe it and then later I have to shred those notes. Like it just like, it doesn't make any sense, but that's how the information is going to go into my head so I can process it in real time. So, I mean, I think everybody's brain is wild.
The brain is wild. Speak to it. What's wild about the brain?
So it's something so interesting, like with different areas of medicine, like the heart, the lungs, it's so algorithm based. Like, if this goes up, this goes down, you can figure out, you can calibrate, you can do all these things. The brain is so multifocal and complex and interesting, and just like everything is unique to the point that it's difficult to even distinguish what pathology is. I think that's so fascinating that there's so many shades of normal. And it's hard to figure out kind of where people fall on things and figure out causation, and because everything impacts everything in the brain.
I love that you're saying that. There's so many shades of normal, because I think we have this like very typified idea of what intelligence and that smarts and look like. But when you're hearing it from a doctor here who studied the brain about like there's many shades of normal, I don't know. It feels like there's a relief in that.
Yeah.
For me.
I've actually never said that phrase before, but I love it too.
Should we put it on a fucking t-shirt?
I would love it. I'd wear it all the time. Okay. That's happening.
Okay. Merch. Perfect. We'll get that down for sure. But I love that. I mean, it just, you know, we talk about neurotypical, like this expanded range, but really there just is an expanded range. Like, you know, we had to come up with a word to justify the what has typically been this idea of a very limited scope or a limited idea of what the brain does and how it should act. But I love hearing that from you. Is like,
I think the history of the phrase neurotypical or neurodivergent specifically.
Neurodivergence, yeah.
It came about like in the 90s. So it's not that old of a term. And it really was born by a psychologist, and it wasn't a clinical term, it was more like a pop psychiatry term, as a way of reducing stigma of like, it's not bad, it's not good, it's just different. And I think that as we've grown and evolved, looking at different types of neurodivergent, looking at different types of psychiatric phenomena, we've discovered that yes, there are many different, it is not good or bad. It's just different. Brains are wired differently. And this is where we go. And then I think there's kind of a fine line, because I love that reframing of like what we talked about, the different shades of normal. I love that part, but I also do really intrinsically find value in the disordered part, because I think in that way it indicates clinical severity, which I think that sometimes when you move too far into this, like, removing pathology from it, you lose some of that. And it's like, everybody does that. And it's like, no. Not everybody does that. And this is something that it needs to be taken seriously and be accommodated. And this is something that people need to know about and kind of recalibrate for.
You just did one of my favorite things.
What?
Which is nuance the shit out of that. Which is... which we're also putting on a t-shirt. You just nuanced the shit out of that, which is like going, yes, there's an importance of humanizing. There's an importance of humanizing our very varied brain processes. And there is still value in saying there's an edge to which some things vary maybe too much or need more special focus and attention because of how far they vary.
Yeah.
And we can still treat it with kindness, but it's also important to identify those markers.
Totally.
And so thanks for building that tension and that nuance between humanism and clinical significance.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's important to kind of flesh out the boundaries of both of those. Right? Because that's what you kind of have to do when you're looking into things. Like, how much of this is like part of the human experience and how much of this do I need a doctor for?
Hello, call me.
Yeah.
And I meant to say neurodivergent earlier and said neurotypical, same. Which is,
I mean, like,
funny.
But conceptually, as a way of distinguishing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is like, I think for those of us, and we'll get into it very soon, like those of us who were very neurodivergent, especially as kiddos, like, were shamed. I was shamed for having severe learning disabilities and ADD and dyslexia and just the gamut, you know? And there's a way in which I think as a child, I carried a lot of that into my adulthood. And I'm curious if you did, like what your experience was with that.
So my experience was a little weird in that I was diagnosed in fourth grade. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to say how old I am, but I am elderly. Like, this was during a time where ADHD just wasn't talked about. And yeah. So it just wasn't part of like this cultural phenomenon, so much so that girls weren't being diagnosed at all, really. And the reason it got picked up is because I was so hyperactive. I presented like a boy. And so super disruptive in class. Eventually it got like escalated to like the teachers talked to my parents. And so my parents got me evaluated. It was ADHD. They started me on medication. But again, it had so much stigma around it that they didn't tell me. So I was on medication. It was my vitamin. I would take my vitamin every day. And it was like, this is going to help you focus, which it like straight up did. So I was like, all right, cool. But like, I didn't actually know like, hey, you carry this diagnosis. Hey, this is a prescription medication for ADHD. Like, did not know any of that stuff. And that continued up until I was getting ready to go to medical school. So I know. So like, I get out of high school, getting ready to go to medical school. And like, it was the first time I was by myself. I obviously stopped taking my vitamin. Everything falls apart. And then like, I'm on the precipice of fully getting kicked out of this program because I was like, what? I thought I had a stroke. I was like, there's like, my brain is not braining. What's happening? Like, the thing that put me on academic probation that first semester is because I studied so hard for this neurology exam, so hard. And I got a 32%, which was like the lowest in the class by far. I got 100% on the first side of the page, and I didn't flip over the other side, and I turned in the thing, and the guy wouldn't let me take it over. Like, I was like, I'll do it orally. Like, you can test me. I have no idea why I didn't flip over the page. So, I mean, it was like stuff like that over and over and over and over and over again. Like, you have to turn this in or you won't get credit. Okay, I'm going to the place. I have my stuff. It's in my backpack. I am ready to turn this in. I get distracted by one thing. I don't make it there. The cutoff is over. Like, it's stuff like that that was happening again and again and again. And then, you know, I went home. And I was like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. This is horrible. My parents were like, okay. Well, it's actually ADHD. This is what's going on. And then we just spent a week trying to like immerse myself in that. And like, I fought against it. I was like, I don't think this is me. But the more I learned about it, I was like, this sounds exactly like me. and then it was a journey of like finding the right medication and stuff.
Wait, what was that like for you to suddenly like, I mean, because it kind of sounds like you were kept out of something really important. You were kept in the shadows of something that was happening to you.
I mean, I've thought about this a lot, and I've thought about this, like, I've thought about how I felt at the time, which was, like, very mad, very betrayed, very, like, just, like, and I think that's what pushed me away from medication for a long time, because I was like, I don't need it. I was given medication without my consent for so long, and, like, I can do this without it. But I think when I go back, and, like, part of this is, like, what has helped me reframe this also is having my own children. Like, the world is such a, you as a parent and like, you know, as a provider of any sort of capacity, you just want to take care of those people you love and you want to make sure that life isn't hard for them. And my parents felt like, you know, I am literally the only person of diversity in the school. I already felt super different. I, you know, like stuff like that. They were like, you were already so marginalized and so hyper aware of that, that we didn't want to add more. So we thought this would help you. And like, it just like, it continued and continued and continued. And I was like, listen, man, I get the reasoning behind it. That was the wrong move, but okay. And like, and they even admit like, we should have talked to you. This should have been part of the conversation, but we literally didn't have the verbiage or know how to do that. And it wasn't as much in the like cultural zeitgeist as it is now. So I think that, yeah, it was hard at that time. I think I'm more measured about how I feel about it now.
I want to take a moment to give a loud shout out to The Embody Lab, which is one of the most incredible resources for body-based and somatic therapies. This show is all about healing, and The Embody Lab does exactly that. Whether you're on your own journey of transformation and discovery, or enhancing your skill sets in your career as like a coach or a therapist, a body worker, or really any career where you are supporting other gently used humans, The Embody Lab is your place for deep, inspiring, and impactful workshops, certificates, masterclasses, and an incredible community of like-minded folks. I love the Embody Lab, and so do so many other people that call it a platform to come home to over and over again. The Embody Lab is giving my listeners an exclusive offer, a one-time 10% off code to enhance your embodied well-being. All you have to do is go to theembodylab.com and use the code GENTLYUSE10 at checkout. Yeah, my heart goes out to the little Sasha. Like, I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, I know.
Like, because it's, I mean, we can, as adults, we can say, like, I wasn't given consent about medication.
Yeah.
I wasn't even informed. And then more so in the story, I mean, it just breaks my heart to get to a place where you'd stop taking your vitamins and you don't know what's going on with you because it hasn't been disclosed.
Yeah. And I just, like, when that all kind of happened and I kept making errors and I was like, my sleep schedule was off and I wouldn't, like, I went, like, I'm pretty tall, which is also surprising for people on the internet. They're like, I'm like 5'8", 5'9". Everyone thinks I'm a lot smaller than that, but no. But I like dropped to like 90 pounds because I just would forget to eat for days. Like I just was like trying to study and do all of this stuff and I just wouldn't eat. And then I would be like, why am I crying all the time? And it's like, oh, I haven't eaten at all. And so like all of it, I was just so incredibly dysregulated. I had gone from so much structure to having nothing and just falling apart and not knowing how to eat, not knowing how to sleep, not knowing how to drink, not knowing how to like do any of those basic things to sustain me in any sort of capacity, that like I truly did think that there was something very physiological happening with me. I was like, is it a stroke? Is it like some sort of neurological event? Like, am I getting dementia? Like, why can't I remember to do things? So those were the things I was looking at before ADHD. Didn't even think about ADHD.
Did you find relief at some point from the, like, after you were settled into identifying with it?
So I think for as difficult the journey was to get to that point, like with my parents not knowing how to broach it, I think they did a phenomenal, like, 180 in parenting because they really dove in and it became like this thing where I flew home, my dad and I and my mom, we just like were getting books from the library and like looking up stuff on the internet and like trying to piece together everything we could about ADHD. And I think that being able to like be away from school, away from those stressors, being in my safe kind of environment with my mom and my dad and be able to explore all those things and ask questions and be like, did I do this? Did I do this? Like talk about all of that and learn in such like, it's almost like a crash course, but in like such a loving and supportive way. Mm-hmm. I think it changed everything because I was like, oh, okay, this isn't like, I have a reason for it. It did give me some relief. Like there is something happening. I understand it. Then I got like, it was really hard for me to find a medication because the medication I was on before just like didn't work now. And I don't know whether it was like I was in a different spot in my life or hormones changed or I was older. Or, but then I became really discouraged with that whole process because I was like, what am I working so hard for? Like nothing is working. Mm-hmm. But then eventually I found something that worked relatively well and was able to kind of build skills. And then when I was in residency, that's when things really got restructured and like, I was literally surrounded by psychiatrists and therapists the whole time, which was amazing. 10 out of 10 recommend. Like people should always do that. But like they really cultivated. It was like such a small program. They really, really took an interest in not just like my academic performance, but like who I was as a person, how I was growing, how I was developing, what my level of happiness and every facet of life was. And so that's when I really started to build behavioral skills. And then with that and medication, it got me to a spot where I felt like for the first time in a really long time, very, very stable. And then stable enough that I could take those behavioral things and get off of medication to where I am now, which is, you know, loud, but okay.
Just fucking loud. Yeah. When you say behavioral things, are you talking about like mindfulness and other focal practices, that type of stuff?
But also like stuff like I mean, I had an attending named Dr. Friedman who mm-hmm. was like, do you know how to eat? And I was like, I don't know. How do other people eat? Like, because he, like, we would be together so much, like, seeing patients, and I was on consult liaison, and so I was, like, around the hospital all the time, and he's like, I've been with you for 10 hours, and you, like, have eaten, like, you'll eat so much at one point, and then you'll feel really sleepy, and then it'll be hard for you to get around, so you just, like, pound a bunch of caffeine, and then you get anxious. So then you eat something sweet, and it's like you don't have any concept of like nutritional value and how you should be eating. And I was like, I don't think I do. Because it would be like, I would go from like gut stuff, like, what am I feeling in that moment? And then I would also have these periods of time where I was like, I'm so busy that I don't really think about eating, or I'll eat whatever's easy. And really, that would make me super hyper, or that would crash me down, or things like that. And so he would, like, actually, what you should eat for breakfast, you should be 2 to 3 hours later. And like stuff that I'm like, why didn't that come naturally to me? Why haven't I? And I think I was just in fight or flight so long with schooling that I never had that opportunity to learn it. So it's stuff like that. Eating, drinking, like, yes, mindfulness was huge. Organizing, how to break down a task. Like, those are all things that I felt like I was very much taught. It didn't come naturally to me.
No, I mean, those are hard things, maybe for us, not
maybe,
for everyone.
Maybe go to my psych program. They were awesome.
I mean, for me, both my sister and I were diagnosed with ADHD. She kind of wore the flag proud, and I felt mortified by it. Mm-hmm. And they put me on medication. I guess I must have been in fourth or fifth grade, mm-hmm. similar to
same,
you.
Same, yeah.
And I did it for a few years, and they kept saying to my parents, I don't feel like me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel like it's me. I feel controlled, and was really like adamant about it. And I was already practicing yoga and mindfulness around, like, as I got into like sixth, seventh grade, mm-hmm. and doing things like dance. And I was like, there's something out there, and doing yoga and dance and stuff that I was like, that's helping.
That's more my vibe. Yeah.
And the medic, I know, it's wild. Mm-hmm. And they eventually let me come off medication. And I think I was early in high school when I came off of it. Mm-hmm. And they let me do it with like natural herbs.
Love it.
And that I had researched, and yoga and mindfulness and all those things. And but most importantly, as you're talking about nutrition, I radically eliminated everything from my diet mm-hmm. by the time I got to 9th grade or 10th grade. So I took out gluten, I took out soy, I took out dairy, I took out sugar, and my brain started working more. Mm-hmm. And I started going to therapy more. Mm-hmm. And then my brain really started to work. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, shit. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And probably why I went into pediatrics, because I was like, why didn't anyone, when I was a kid, give me any of this, mm-hmm. because I hated how I felt on medication. Mm-hmm. I literally felt like someone jumped into my brain and was pulling on wires like I was a puppet.
Mm-hmm. That's how I felt like that. I think I was so young when I was initially on medication that I didn't know what me felt like. And like, I didn't know I was on medication. So I didn't know if it was any different. But when I was trying it again in medical school, there were certain ones where I'm like, I have no personality, or I'm like, if I was on the phone with someone, they could tell if I was medicated or if I wasn't. And I was like, I don't love that. But for the record, like, I'm still very much pro medication. It sounds like I'm not, because I've had kind of a rough go. But I think if I hadn't been on, I know, I just have this messed up history with medication. But like, if I hadn't have been on medication during medical school, I would not have gotten through. And I'm leaving the door, even though I'm not on medication now, if something changes in the future, and if I will happily start medication again, if I need that kind of moving down the line. So I think it just depends on people. But I think there's a lot of value in, like, I had to do an elimination thing too. Like, I've been gluten free, and I've done that kind of sporadically through my life. And for a long time, I was like, oh, I thought the gluten was helping with like digestive stuff, and that I could appreciate. Mm. I didn't tie together the gluten and the brain fog for me. And that's really the thing that's at, like, bloated. All right, fine. I will roll the dice. Like, I don't care. But
I'll eat that fucking pizza.
Yeah, right? I don't care. And like dairy, don't care. Like cheese, I will never work that out of my diet. No, I don't care. But if it's going to impact my brain health and how I process things and how, and like my capacity to emotionally regulate, that is the only thing that will keep me from sticking a full loaf of bread in my mouth. Because it's like gluten. I love gluten. Love it. But it makes me dumb.
Yeah.
I have a delayed processing speed. Like when people say things to me, it takes me longer to figure out what they're saying and organize it in my brain and formulate a response.
Isn't it wild that you and you and I are around the same age, that we grew up in a time, we're both 25, for those who are wondering.
Okay, perfect. Yep, accurate.
All right. Yeah. Clear. We both grew up in a time, this was before, quote unquote, food sensitivities.
Totally.
And like, you know, it's funny to me, like a lot of people around me, they're like, everyone's got a gluten sensitivity now. And I was like, okay.
They probably do.
But like, and they probably do. And they might not, but at least they feel better. Like something, maybe their brain works better. And like, let's not poo-poo on that. But it is interesting that we grew up in a time where it's like I remember going to the doctor when I was a kid and complaining of migraines and headaches and gut pain and inability to like remember stuff. And I was young, like 6, 7. And they told my parents to take salt out of my diet. Less pickles is what they said. Less pickles. And that's why I can't eat pickles now. No. But I was,
are you really?
Nowadays,
they
probably.
Eat pickles?
No, of course
I eat pickles. Oh, I was like, don't be crazy. Give that up. You should definitely eat pickles. They're so good.
But I didn't for years as a kid because that's what they assumed all those issues were coming from was the sodium, which is just like, wah, wah.
Yeah, wrong.
So wrong. Yeah. So wrong. Where it's supposed to like nowadays, you know, when a kid comes in with this type of things, I mean, granted, I was one of those practitioner doctors that got to say like, let's check this out and let's check that out. But, you know, it's interesting. I just really appreciate the evolution. And speaking of evolution, how's that for a transition?
Love it.
Speaking of evolution of ADHD, like how are we at? Where are we at with all of this? Where I think maybe everyone's self-diagnosis is from the internet?
Yeah.
Or like, are there more cases? Is it just more readily available of information? Have we, our brains been shifting because of all the technology? What the fuck is going on?
You're going to hate my answer because it's really wishy-washy.
I'm so excited to hate your answer.
So my is like, all of that is so nuanced. Put it on the shirt.
Get me in the nuance.
Yeah. So, because I think it's dependent on patient population. I think it's dependent on socioeconomics. I think it's dependent on cultural stuff. Like, there are huge subsets of people that I think are overdiagnosed. And I will readily say that. I think that especially with COVID, where we're all forced internally and everybody had their phones and that was like their only outlet, you got this huge boom in ADHD diagnosis. And, you know, people were coming into my office via telehealth. And so much of the time I'd be like, no, this isn't ADHD. This is like normal human experience, but this isn't limiting to you in any way. This started when you moved to remote work. This like, this is not ADHD. So I felt like I was just like, kind of like, nope.
Slapping the
right. No, it's not.
Swiping left on the ADHD diagnosis.
Nope. And I was part of the problem, right? Because I'm putting a lot of ADHD educational stuff out on like TikTok and Instagram. So they would come in literally holding up my video. And I was like, yeah, but not for you. So, I mean, it like.
You're not part of the club.
No, not you. So I think that there is a proportion that's overdiagnosed. There's also a really huge proportion that's underdiagnosed. I mean, if you look at kind of global models, and even if you looked nationally and you're starting to look at stuff like based by race and socioeconomic stuff, if you're looking at like into specific minority groups, those are people that are getting, you know, instead of corrective measures and looking into ADHD and things like that, they're entering, you know, juvenile detention systems, and they're getting in-school suspensions, and they're not getting the 504 plans, they're not getting an IEP, they're getting like punitive measures. So I think that it really depends. And I think that we're talking about it more. Yes. Are we diagnosing it more? Maybe, because we know about it more, but I don't think that the amount of ADHD has gone up. I think we're just more aware of it. So I don't know. It's all, I didn't give you a single answer. There you go.
No, I'm more interested in the nuance anyways. I mean, I do know, I've seen like some studies that say that the rates, quote unquote, have risen, but so is the population.
Yeah, I don't think that's an accurate thing. And I think that if you were really giving me good, clear statistical data, you would tell me, where did the rates rise? What population did it rise in? When did it rise? What age group did it rise in? Like, give me actual data. That's a dumb number.
Yeah.
It's a dumb statistic.
Well, I know you're not saying you as in me, but...
You give me dumb statistics.
You, Scott, give me better numbers. You're an asshole. Statistical asshole. I remember one study that said, and this is years ago, more in grad school, that piqued my interest, that said that the rates were rising in the U.S., where rates in other countries, quote-unquote third world countries, were not rising in the same direction. And I was like, oh. So what it didn't go into is like, what are the reasons? Is there more education? So there's more diagnosis, more education about this specific topic. And so there's more diagnosis. Is it that people are more self-diagnosing and doctors are going along with it? You know, like, et cetera.
Access to care is a huge thing.
I don't know. Does that resonate?
Like, access to care is a huge thing, too. Like, I mean, if you're in, like, Canada or London or stuff where you get these huge centralized kind of universal healthcare systems, which, you know, definitely there's some positives, but, like, you can also get stuck on a waiting list for 3 years before you see a practitioner for something that seems like a voluntary psychiatric evaluation for this. So, like, is it that those numbers are actually that different? I don't know. Like, you really do need to know the why.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really important. Speaking of why, how's that for transition? I'm curious where you, in your work, connect with, like, Gaber Mate's work on ADHD and, like, that perspective.
I get this question.
Which I can say just to the audience is about, like, looking at generational stress
and trauma.
And trauma as the culprit, and that it's reversible.
So I get this question all the time.
Oh, really?
All the time. And I
thought I was unique.
No. But here's where you are unique, because in previous podcasts, I've been like, cut it out, because I don't think I have a good, solid answer about it. And I've tried to like tiptoe around it, because I think his work is very important. I think it resonates with a lot of people. I think there is a huge impact that trauma has on a developing brain and even a non-developing brain. Like, trauma messes up the brain. Like, you just operate differently after trauma, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that trauma can cause a spectrum of symptomology that can look like ADHD, but I don't think it's ADHD. Yes. And I don't think trauma causes ADHD. And I think that to say that this is simply from a generational trickle down and separated from like the genetic component. And yes, that, you know, when you're looking at like epigenetics and things like that about how things can actually be worked into your DNA, then I think you get into like shades and nuance and you don't really know like what is coming from what. But I don't think it's solely because of trauma. I just don't. And I think that there is a lot. I mean, you could go back into my life, you could go into my family tree, you could see things. And yes, we've had some difficult things happen, but I don't think that this was how I was raised. I don't think this was how my parents were raised. I think this was ADHD, and I see it in my mom, and I see it in my grandparents, and I see like different shades of it. Like, I think it's distinct. And while I think that there is room in this like ADHD etiology umbrella for like trauma could worsen things, I don't think it's causative.
This show is also brought to you by the absolutely stunning and powerful tools for transformation that are created by Omala. Oof, even the name Omala transports you to a place of flow and vitality. These are some of my favorite products ever, like an amazing color-changing yoga mat that responds to your temperature and presence and reflects back your posture in real time. They have this incredible smelling skin balm candle that heats up to activate all the essential oils and vitamins that your skin has been craving for. I mean, look, if I could live in a giant bath of this candle, I would 100% do it. They also have these journals that lead you into a profound insight, and then you can plant those journals to create a stunning flower garden. I mean, damn, if that's not both deep and inventive, I don't know what is. If you're someone who desires to live in a luxurious flow of life and who believes in transformative wellness, then you have to check out Omala. Omala is giving my listeners an exclusive discount to treat yourself to something that is as special as you, boo. All you have to do is go to omala.com, that's omala.com, use the discount code DrScott10 at checkout, and a portion of every purchase goes to an incredible charity. You got this. Yeah, thank you for not making us cut it out, because I think it is important what you're sharing. It's like in the same vein when someone, like I've said to people even on the show, when they're like, oh, you know, when someone has cancer, it's because they didn't process some emotions. And I'm like, I think it's more nuanced than that. Like, it could be, but it can also not be. Like, there are other factors. And so I appreciate that we're not saying all of these symptoms have to be from trauma. Like, there are other contributing factors that are important to recognize. And I think you were saying something interesting, too, of like, there are symptoms from trauma that can look very, be in parallel or look very similar to ADHD. And I've had that question for my life, because when I started doing more somatic trauma work, somatic experiencing, you know, like Peter Levine's work and other somatics, a lot of my attentional stuff did shift, especially when I went and did something called neurodevelopmental therapy. So really repatterning through movement practices. And then doing some of the emotional stuff. And it really shifted significantly. And the things that didn't shift, that's where I'm able to say, like, I think that's the ADHD. But all the other shit that also got in the way, I was like, that's the trauma. That was the trauma. That was the nutritional issues. Like, and it was layered. Like, so my whole experience was layered as opposed to like one solid thing, which is goes back to the nuance and the uniqueness of each of our brains. And
that's
our
why his work grabs hold of so many people. And and this is why previously I've wanted to cut it out, because I was not cool about it. Just not measured in any sort of capacity. I think I've gotten better at talking about it. But I think the way he explains his story and the way he explains his experience and the way that he can tie everything together, I think that is an incredibly compelling story. And I think that he thinks that is the lump sum of all of it. That is what is causing it. And that's how he healed it and all of that stuff. But I think, just like you were saying, I think the human experience and the brain is so complicated. There's so many things that affect so many different things that I think if you're just looking at trauma, and even if you were to dedicate your whole life to trying to fix that trauma, I don't think you're going to get to the bottom of it. I think it's so multifocal. In order to have a good answer to what you're feeling internally, you have to have it be a multifocal approach.
Yeah, I truly believe that. And it goes, I mean, we've been giving examples in this podcast of like, hey, there's like getting back into movement and like giving and organizing behaviors and learning to do these type of tasks, and there's could be medication, and there could be all of these things, really illuminates that it's layered, that's nuanced, and that there is no one approach. Doing trauma work might be the trick for someone, and it might not be. And I think that's really important. In any humanistic approach, it's so important to recognize one thing is not the cure-all.
And I think that's why so many people, they ignore the movement side of things, they ignore the diet side of things, they ignore just like all those other things because they're like, I need to focus on that one thing that's going to cure all of it. And it's like, everything touches everything. You need to work all of it. And it could be like you're spending a little bit more focused energy on one thing versus the other. But I think if you just threw all your eggs in one basket, you're never going to get comprehensive resolution. And you're not going to learn how to manage it as well. Because I think you have to understand how to manage your food intake, your water intake, your exercise intake, because that's going to sustain you on a daily level.
Absolutely. So well said. How do we, like, you created a whole like app, a whole system essentially of supporting people. And so I'm wondering, like, if you can talk about some of the things, you know, again, there's no cure-all, but what are some of the significant things that you like guide people towards in navigating? To me, it's not just ADHD, even though that might be kind of the marketing of it. It's really about like attention.
Totally.
If I can say, be so blunt
you
are, about it.
You can absolutely be so blunt. So when I was trying to figure out how to make this app, and like that was born by like, okay, I wrote a book. I don't want to read. Like, what else am I going to do? I like tried to figure out what is the thing that potentially helped me the most and continues to help me. And I think it was a two-prong kind of thing. Number one is the educational component. I think understanding my brain, like what my dad and I did in that like crash course where I learned about ADHD, that gave me the basis and understanding to one, remove stigma for myself, like just for myself. And two, gave me the foundational understanding of like, if I fix some of these things, how it's going to impact my brain. So that I think was really important. And with that educational component, I think also understanding my own patterns was really important in all of that, like understanding and tracking. So I knew what my normal cycles and patterns were. The second thing is actually having productivity tools. Like, okay, now I have this understanding of ADHD and myself. How am I going to employ differences? And that's like, how do I break down a task? So I'm going to use a task timer. How do I break down a huge laundry list of things to do? Okay, I'm going to prioritize it. I'm going to put it by category and I'm going to make it gamified so I can like enjoy using it. How am I going to remind myself to be mindful? Okay, let me put in a journal. It's too hard to just journal dump on a blank page. Let me do a prompt so I can see how I change year to year. So it's stuff like that, that I think really, you know, putting that all and amalgamating it into one app. I used it for 8 months solidly before like the beta came out. And in that 8 months, and like I was tweaking things as it went through. And like one of our biggest delays is because I was like, I just want to put research with this. So like I had to go back and rework the entire app and like cite all my research. But like, I think that when I was going through it, I was actually like understood stuff better. Like I was tracking all of like, there's a focus tracker where it talks about your sleep, your appetite, your water intake, your impulsivity, all of that stuff. And I was like, that's weird. Like, I have 4 days of horrible impulsivity every month. What is happening? And I was like, okay.
Okay. I don't know. What else happened once a month?
Interesting. So then I was like, that can't be true. Like, that's insane. And so I went to like my cycle tracking app and I was like, oh, it's the 4 days before my period starts. And then I was like, okay, so I'm saying I'm impulsive, but I don't know if that really makes a difference. Then I went into my Chase app. I was looking at my credit card statements. There's a $600 bump because I just sit on the couch and I like try to like, I don't know. I just like impulse shop. Like I do, like I just get, and it's always like kitchen utensils and crazy stuff that I'm like, I'm never going to use this. Like I bought like this robotic mop. Where I'm like, I don't even know, like, why am I doing this? But like, I think it's a really good, I'll see something on TikTok and then I'll immediately, there's no thought process behind it. I'm like, oh, need that. So it's like, I know that like that 4 days of a month, do not get me on that couch. It's over for me.
Do you help people track that in your app?
Yeah. So the great thing about that focus tracker is like when you're doing all of that, it's like a visual depiction. So I was looking at that graph and I was like, what's happening? And then I was like, that's weird that this happened in October and September and August and July. And I was like, that all of that is really weird. Why is that happening? And then I was like, interesting. And then that's when I looked back and I was like, oh my God. So I think it is a very valuable tool.
So some of your app is about tracking. Is it tracking sleep?
So it tracks sleep. Well? It tracks food intake. Like if you're taking breakfast, lunch, yeah. dinner, it tracks water intake. It tracks impulsivity. It tracks focus. And it tracks mood.
Ooh, that's a lot to track. So there's a psychoeducation piece about tracking. Mm-hmm. And we know that tracking alone has an impact and yet doesn't derive from tracking. Mm-hmm. So what happens next after I track all this?
I think the tracking itself is number one, teaching you to be more mindful about your patterns, because I think that's bringing awareness to what you're doing. But number two, I think it's just a more streamlined approach to problem solving. So for me, it was like, okay, I'm tracking and that's making me more mindful. And then I didn't actually gather data from it. And then 8 months down the line, I was just like looking at those graphs, because then you can go back and look at the graphs from the month before or the 7 days before. And I was looking at those graphs and I was like, my graphs look exactly the same, except for this period over and over and over again. And so then I'm like, okay, let me just look into that. And so it helps you problem solve when you're tracking that and you're like, what is that? And now I will distinctly make behavioral changes around that. I'm not like, you will not catch me on the couch those 4 days. Yeah. I do not want to spend $600 on mops. That's not my goal for those 4 days. So I do other stuff. Like during that time, not so you guys are so intimately involved with my cycle, but like a couple of weeks ago during that time, I was like, okay, instead of me just like kind of chilling out on the couch, I'm going to do something. Like, and so I attempted to play pickleball, or I went to go, like, I wanted to go swim, or I decided, you know, I'm going to organize, like, I just hyper-focused into organizing something. So I was away from my phone. And so I redid my laundry room organizational area. So like, I recognize that those are like traps for me. That 4 days is a trap for me. And I was like, nope, not this month. So I'm eager to see what that, my chase statement hasn't hit yet. We'll see what it says.
Do keep us up to date. Well. And you also have like mindfulness practices to like kind of do the rewiring as well.
Yeah, I think the journaling is super, super helpful. Journaling. One of my favorite things is like, for me, I don't know if it's the same with you, Scott. I'm so moved by music. And I've always been like, that's been something that I've connected to in a very real way. So with like pairing with like tasks and things like that, it as part of like the task timer and to break down tasks, you can pair it with like an audio that like brown noise to enhance like focus inducing waves. And, you know, you can do like lo-fi music. Some people really feel like they can get into a groove with kind of that because it's not overly distracting, you know, so things like that. I think there are other ways that you can kind of help ease yourself into a mindful place. Because I think if you were just like to put me in a vacuum outside of practicing and be like, spend this time and be mindful, I'd be like, go to hell. Like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to be mindful. And I think that it's just a matter of like what really helped me reframe mindfulness and my own yoga practice and things like that. It's like, I think I was so fixated on making my brain quiet. And it will never be quiet. Like my brain, it has never, ever, ever, ever been quiet. And I think now what I've gotten to is my mindfulness practice is being able to observe my thoughts mindfully and without much reaction to it. So I'm just kind of observing how I'm thinking, how I'm processing. And in a way, they slow down because of that. But I don't think they ever get quiet.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I was working in pediatrics and this parent who is observing the session, and I was talking to them I was talking to them after the session ish the parent, and the kid was sitting on a bench and moving his knee up and down, and the mom turned to him and said, calm yourself.
And you're like, and he is,
this was after our first session, and I said, oh, maybe he is exactly what you're saying. Maybe the movement is about regulating. And I said, you know, it's interesting the language we use, because don't you think if he knew how to calm himself, he would? Maybe it hasn't been modeled. Maybe the idea of calm is different between you and him. Like, you know, it's starting to offer this education to people who don't have sort of that neurodivergent
framework.
A framework. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the other things I wanted to go with you through, which was super helpful for me, was understanding, because when we think of attention, we might just think of like this broad category. It's just attention. Yeah. Either you're good at it or you're not. You have some, you don't, da 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 da. But there's actually a lot of different types of attention. I'm going to list five. So the types of attention, sustained attention, which is the form of attention also known as concentration. Mm-hmm. And then there's alternating attention. This involves like multitasking or effortlessly shifting between two or more things. So back and then forth. Mm-hmm. Then there's selective attention, which is the ability to attend to a limited resource or one selective thing we focus on. Then there's focused attention. This type of attention involves being able to suddenly be drawn into like a specific visual or auditory or tactile stimuli. So like I snap and the ability to shift or attend to that. So that's focused attention. And then there's limited attention, which is a funny term. Limited attention is also known as divided attention. And so it's a form of attention that involves essentially multitasking. But what's different than alternating is that the attention is divided between multiple tasks simultaneously rather than shifting. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of, I'm putting those out there. We have sustained, alternating, selective, focused, and limited.
Yeah.
One of the things that was helpful for me was to go, oh, this is a strength. And then this is like really something I'm not so clear about as to how to do. Now, turn it to you. Just like, are there ones that you found that are like ones you built in skill, ones that you were had always, or?
I think I'm still working on sustained attention. Concentration is a hard thing for me to do. And it's hard for me to do in long periods of time. I can do it like if I really focus, but I think just external world things. I mean, now you're getting to the point where like, even your phone isn't that much of a distraction, but we all have Apple Watches. So now it's like on my body, I'm getting distracted. So, you know, so that can be harder for me. I think with attention in general, I historically have a hard time when it comes to shifting focus from one thing to another. Either I will be drawn in by something else kind of suddenly, and I am in that limited focus where I'm distractible and I'm kind of moving, and it's just a very inefficient use of time because I feel like I've thought about 50 different things and I've gotten nothing done. Or I've gotten into a flow where I'm multitasking, but I feel like even if I'm getting really good at that, in that flow, I can distract myself away from what I'm doing. Like I end up multitasking too many things, and then it's like, what was the original plot of this movie? Like where, what was I supposed to be doing? So that, I mean, that's kind of, that's where I am on those focus spectrums.
Yeah. Thanks for naming that. In the same vein of like, we're all so different. I found as a kid, focused attention was not something I would be so in the tunnel vision of attention that there would be a loud sound and I wouldn't hear it or a light would turn on and off and I wouldn't notice it. And I, as an adult, love multitasking. It's just so stimulating and like...
You should have done ER.
I read all the paper. I know. I worked in pediatrics.
I think you're that's good. Same.
Oh gosh, ER. But I love it. It's just so invigorating to me. And I read all these papers of like, multitasking is so deteriorating to your capacity. And I'm like, no, it's enjoyable.
Enhancing. This is working.
I am loving it. And I think it's important just to recognize like what is strengths and like, and where is, you know, as we're, I think both of us can say like, we're working on sustained attention.
It's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress. And to recognize like, yeah, there are things like technology that are pulling us out of our attention. Yeah. And I just want to name that as even a wrap up piece here of like, we're so used to all the distractions, like all the notifications that pop us up, that we're recognizing in neuroscience that we start to interrupt ourselves in the absence of those.
Isn't that wild?
And that's really important to recognize of like when you're interrupting yourself as well as when you're being interrupted in your attention. Oof, we got to get some focus. We got to get your app. We got to work some shit.
Yeah, we do.
Sasha, thank you.
You're welcome.
We got to work it. And thank you so much for being here. Where can people find you in the world? Where can people hang out with you?
Well, you can hang out with me in this upstairs bedroom office because that's where I'll be forever. In terms of where to find me, I am on social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm on YouTube. And it's the Psych Doctor MD. Or you can type in my name, Sasha Hanani. My book is Self-Care for People with ADHD. That was released by Simon & Schuster in January. And then my app, Focus Genie, is out. It just got released in September. So that's out on the App Store and Android. Or what is it? Google Play.
It's been a big year for you.
It's been a big year. Yeah.
Google Play. Yeah. It's been a big year.
It's been a weird year.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Gently Used Human podcast with Dr. Scott Lyons and friends. Visit gentlyused.com for fun extras, including submitting your questions for advice from a Midwestern mom. And don't forget to spill the tea and gossip about the show with all your friends and frenemies. And show some love by giving us 5 stars and leaving a review in your favorite apps. This helps us connect with all the other gently used humans out there. Oh, and by the way, you look fierce today.